Hello, and welcome to the Autism and Sleep podcast hosted by Amaze. My name's Daniel. Thank you for joining me today. It is estimated that somewhere between 50 to 80% of autistic children experience sleep problems, compared to roughly 25% of non-autistic children. Today, we'll be discussing why this happens, looking at sleep problems in autistic children and some strategies that can help improve your child's sleep. Before we get into today's discussion, I'd like to introduce our guests. Dr. Lexi Friedenberg is a general pediatrician and educator who is passionate about children's and adolescents' health, development, and well-being. She has been working in pediatrics for 20 plus years and works clinically between a large public children's hospital and Victorian Children's Clinic, a multidisciplinary pediatric practice she co-founded in 2013. As a mother of three, Lexi is passionate about child and family-centered care and is the child health advisor to Vic Health. In addition to this, Lexi is the co-producer and co-host of the Kids Health Information Podcast for the Royal Children's Hospital Melbourne and regularly writes articles and blog posts for parenting websites. Feels like this is barely scratching the surface of the work that you do, Lexi, but we're really grateful that you're on the podcast with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Joining Lexi today is Emily Williamson. Emily is a medical admin worker from regional Victoria and is mother to a nearly 10-year-old girl who is autistic. From a newborn, Emily's daughter struggled to sleep. From age 5, Emily suspected her daughter was autistic before a formal diagnosis at age 6. After trying what felt like everything, including years of co-sleep and different sleep medications, Emily's daughter decided she wanted to sleep alone on the day of her 8th birthday. While her daughter's sleep problems didn't stop there, this is nothing new for the Williamsons, who have all experienced sleep issues at different points in their lives. As a self-described family of night owls, Emily's husband, like their daughter, is autistic, and Emily herself also identifies as neurodivergent. Emily, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I guess we'll start the conversation with you, Lexi. I think it would be great to get an insight on what sleeping problems you tend to see in autistic children and how common that might be.
Thanks, Daniel. Yes, I think you mentioned that sleep problems in all children and adults is incredibly common. So in non-autistic children, we see sleep issues in about 25% of kids, and that goes up to 50 to 80% of children who are autistic have sleep issues at some point in their life, in their childhood. And I try to keep everything quite simple. I think of sleep issues in three main parts. So there's number one, difficulty getting to sleep or falling asleep, which we call sleep initiation issues. Number two is difficulty for the children to stay asleep, which are sleep maintenance issues. And number three are children who don't get enough good quality sleep. So they might not have enough duration of sleep, not enough hours sleep in a night, or they might have multiple overnight wakenings, which means they're not getting great quality sleep. And we know that kids or autistic children are more likely to have bedtime resistance, so, you know, difficulty getting them to sleep, sleep onset delay, so it often takes them a long time to fall asleep. They might have anxiety and they might need a parent to lie with them to get to sleep. They're more likely to have night wakenings, often multiple times a night, which can be really, really challenging. And autistic children tend to have a shorter average sleep time. Some wake quite early, that 4:35 a.m. wakening, which is, once again, incredibly hard, and tend to have worse sleep quality and might have more overnight breathing difficulties or respiratory difficulties as well. So, you know, all children or many children have sleep issues, and many of the common things we see are more common in autistic children.
So from your time working with children experiencing these sleep difficulties, is there anything that you think that parents should be on the lookout for specifically?
I think it's incredibly hard for parents, particularly parents of children with autism, to actually come up with a diagnosis and try and work out what's wrong with their child. I often tell parents, it's not your job to come up with the diagnosis of what sleep issue your child has. What I'd like parents to do is to be able to explain what the issue is for their child, what the issue is for their family. And I always try and empower them to speak to their support people, so their allied health team, their GP, in the younger years, maternal child health nurse, to really talk about what those issues are and help make a plan on how to help the child and the family. When thinking about those issues, you know, as I mentioned, the children who have trouble falling asleep, those sleep initiation issues, most parents know that. The kids take a long time to fall asleep. They're often getting up and down. They're procrastinating. They might need their parent to lie with them till they fall asleep. So most parents know if there's sleep initiation issues. Sleep maintenance issues, so those children who wake many times a night, sometimes parents will know because the children get up and get out of bed, but other times parents might not know. So it's important to think about medical things, medical issues that can cause children to wake overnight. So often sleep disordered breathing issues, so snoring, what we call apneas, where they have pauses in their breathing, bedwetting can cause kids to wake overnight, and seizures, which are more common in autistic children as well. So sleep maintenance issues is really important. And then if your child wakes early, that 4:35 a.m. waker, most parents will know about it, but some children will actually stay in their bed. So they're all the things I ask parents to look out for, but often it's the signs of tiredness that the parents notice. So the next day, the child's really tired. They have to sort of really wake them and shake them to get them out of bed in the morning. They might fall asleep as soon as they get into the car on the way home from school, you know, in that child seat. Often behaviours get worse, so the child might be overwhelmed, they might be irritable, they might be grumpy, and might have more trouble regulating their emotions. So they're often the things that parents notice. And once kids are at school, often the teachers report the child might have poor concentration or learning, or just something seems a bit off. So it's always important to think about sleep.
And so there's obviously that obviously occurs with children who aren't autistic as well, might have sleep issues at school and concentration issues. So how do you think parents might go about differentiating what's normal and abnormal in those behaviours?
Really great question. Parents often ask me, what's normal sleep? So keeping a sleep diary for all parents with children with sleep issues, autistic or not autistic, is really helpful. So you can actually document what the problem is, what's happening when they go to bed, what's happening overnight, what time they're wakening. It's important to, you know, have some idea about what normal sleep is. So we know with younger kids, the 1 to 2 year olds, they need a longer period of sleep, 10 to 14 hours, including their naps. For 3 to 5 year olds, we say 10 to 12 hours, including naps. And for 6 to 12 year olds, 9 to 12 hours. But it's really variable for different children. So different children need different amounts of sleep. Most children, we would like them to fall asleep within 30 minutes. It might be a big ask, but we'd also like them to have about 6 hours of uninterrupted sleep. So I think it's important for parents to know what our goal or our ideal to work towards is.
Thanks, Lexi. So I guess springboarding off that to you, Emily, now, in your own experience with your daughter who's experienced sleep issues, was co-sleeping until the age of 8, what symptoms were you sort of seeing in your daughter from an early age?
Even as a newborn, she's just a very wakeful baby. Naps were extremely difficult. To put her down for a nap would take such a long time, and often was just the point where she would be overtired, cry until she fell asleep. So it was kind of apparent very early. The biggest thing for us as she got older was sleep onset. So it would take easily 3 hours a night for her to fall asleep, and that was with us being with her the whole time. We did have periods where we would be able to leave her once she fell asleep, then go back to our own bed. But then, yeah, we'd have that waking during the night. So co-sleeping was kind of the only way to guarantee that all of us would get a good night's sleep from her when she was older. We didn't do that when she was a baby. But it means no one's sleeping. And it also feeds into when our daughter wasn't diagnosed as autistic straight away, and no one really suspected she was autistic, but there's other things at play as well. You've got the meltdown. So it's kind of the chicken and the egg. Is the lack of sleep causing an increase of meltdowns? We found that when her environment was less predictable and less there was a change, that's when the sleep would, we'd no longer be able to leave her in her bed overnight. She had to be with us. and when she was younger, teething, things like that would kind of, the sleep would be the first thing that would be impacted as well. Yeah, any time that she was kind of struggling with something else in her life, it was kind of sleep was that area she, I suppose, could control and really tried to seek that comfort.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess going back to you, Lexi, from your perspective, working with some of these children who have experienced these sleep issues, could you touch on the possible side effects that someone like Emily's daughter might be experiencing from these sleep issues?
I think Emily described it really well. Poor sleep has a really significant impact on the child, but also significant flow-on effect for the family, often the parents and siblings as well. And you've probably had a few nights without sleep yourself. Sleep deprivation, I used to say, it's a form of torture. It is really, really hard to function when you haven't had a good night's sleep. And when that's cumulative, like when your child hasn't slept for weeks, maybe years, it has a big impact on them, but also on the family. So in general, the health effects, it can affect growth. So some children have trouble putting on weight, and we know when children have sleep apnea and they've had an operation on their tonsils or adenoids to fix that, their growth often improves significantly. So we know sleep can affect growth, but it can also have an effect on children being overweight and obese. It can affect the immune system. So children who have poor sleep over a long period of time may have more infections and may have more trouble fighting those infections. As Emily mentioned, it can have an effect on behaviour and mood and emotional regulation. So, you know, those meltdowns can be incredibly hard for parents and for teachers to help that child, and sleep, poor sleep contributes to that. And in the older children, particularly the school-age children, it can have a significant effect on attention, concentration, their learning, their working memory. And we actually know it can also have an effect on long-term brain development. So really trying to help families early on who have sleep issues is really important. And as Emily said, that flow-on effect to the quality of life of the parents, the siblings, is incredibly important. So there's some general health effects, health and development effects we see, but actually for autistic children, there are some specific effects as well. We see the autistic children have increased communication difficulties if they haven't got enough sleep. Their restrictive and repetitive behaviours might increase. Their sensory sensitivities might increase as well. And that also increases the likelihood of those meltdowns and those difficult behaviours. And as mentioned, that poorer executive function, the organisation, the planning, the working memory, the schoolwork is all really difficult. So that's why we really want to help families as much as we can with these sleep issues.
You're both doing such a good job at answering the questions ahead as well. So I'm just thinking now to you, Emily, was there anything else that affects your family from your daughter's sleeping problems that you could touch on?
Yeah, the impact's huge. And I remember thinking, surely this will end by the time she's at school. And then you get to there and you think, well, surely this can't go on for much longer. And then, it was eight when, like we said, she first slept. Just decided that that's what she wanted to do now, that she wanted to be in her own bed, and was quite happy to do that. She's still, whenever she's a bit unsettled, she'll still climb in with me, and that's perfectly fine. But, she's able to go back now. But it actually was a huge deciding factor for us not to have any more children. I couldn't imagine doing that with another newborn baby. It was just unthinkable for us how we would even cope with that. You know, there's an impact on your relationship if it's taking you 3 hours to get your child to sleep. There's no adult downtime in terms you can't watch a movie or woefully behind in Game of Thrones and all that kind of stuff. I couldn't watch it because it's not appropriate to have it on. And she's up till 11 o'clock if I'm not in the bed with her. It's very socially isolating. So our biggest problem was getting her to sleep. And like I said, it would take easily 3 hours to get her to sleep. But she would sleep through, if she was with us overnight, she would sleep through and actually sleep quite late. So later sleep-ins was quite normal for us, but it's not normal for everyone else. So play groups normally at 10 o'clock. And for us, when you've been up through the night and up very late, for all of us to be out of bed and organised to then go and participate in society, you know, work is very difficult when you're working on no sleep. And then, yeah, you're throwing in all the other, I suppose, aspects of parenting a autistic child with, like I said, the meltdowns. You might have other specialist appointments and other issues that you're trying to resolve, food, and it's just, it's doing all of that, managing all of that on very little sleep. It's torture, to use Jodie's term.
And I'm sure, Lexi, I'm sure you've spoken to a lot of parents in Emily's position through your work, where there's an element of helplessness and you're at that breaking point where you've tried everything. I'm just wondering if you could talk us through some strategies that maybe you found useful for parents with their children to help them sleep better.
Absolutely. I think as Emily's described, parenting an autistic child, particularly one with sleep issues, can be incredibly overwhelming. And it's usually not just the sleep issue you're dealing with, it's the food issues or the sensory issues. So I often say to parents, let's try one thing to start with. Let's really hone in on one aspect of the sleep to focus on and try and make one small change at a time. And let's do it together as a partnership rather than for the parents to feel like they're doing this all alone. Because as you said, Emily, it's incredibly isolating. So the general principles in terms of behavioural management of sleep issues are the same for autistic and non-autistic children. So as a health professional, as a paediatrician, my job is to rule out any coexisting medical issues first. So I want to make sure the child doesn't have sleep disordered breathing, so snoring, allergy or inflammation in their nose, what we call rhinitis, sleep apnea where they might have some pauses and therefore wake up gasping. So sleep disordered breathing, incredibly common and important to rule out. We might see children who have seizures, so I want to make sure we've got good seizure control. As I mentioned, bedwetting. We know that children with eczema, which is incredibly common in kids as well, have dry and itchy skin, and that often wakes them. And we also know if a child's been a really good sleeper and they have sudden onset sleep issues, particularly in non-verbal autistic children, you need to think about, is there an infection, like an ear infection? Do they have an abscess in their gum? Do they have constipation, but they can't tell you they're in pain? So I think it's important to think of, if they've been a good sleeper and suddenly have an issue, it's quite different than if they've always had an issue sleeping. So I think the general principles are the same, but there are a few that are even more relevant in autistic children. Sleep hygiene, incredibly important. I heard the term keep bedtime vanilla, and I really like that. So keep it really boring as much as you can for the child. So setting a regular bedtime and a regular wake time, so that consistency is important. The sleep environment is really important. So autistic children often have particular sensitivities to noise or light or temperature, but every child is different. So some children might like white noise in the room, but others might like complete silence and to use some earplugs. Some might like a nightlight, or others might like complete darkness and have an eye mask on. I think most children, we don't want to overheat the room, but some children like that security of a heavy blanket or a weighted blanket. So you've got to think about that sleep environment. Bedtime routine, incredibly important. So really wind down with the bath, a book, bed. But particularly with autistic children, telling your child what's going to happen, either making a social story for them, a visual schedule where you put pictures or photos and put it on their wall, can be really helpful. And lots of praise and reinforcement. In general, as you all know, kids thrive on routine that's consistent and predictable, and that's even more so with kids who are on the autism spectrum. The other things we recommend: avoiding caffeine or caffeinated drinks before bed or during the day at all, removing any electronics in the bedroom and not letting your child be on electronics 1 hour before bed. As a parent of three, much easier said than done.
I was going to ask about that because it's just, for me personally, it's very hard.
It's so hard. I don't want you to come to my house and see what actually happens. But, you know, we're all addicted to our devices. But I think as parents, you know, it's something you can really try, because we know device time before bed usually impairs their ability to fall asleep.
Yeah.
And we also say lots of physical activity during the day, but try not to do too much excitement or exercise just before bed. And as we'll talk about later, trying to get a child to fall asleep independently without a parent or a sleep association, as you said, Emily, much easier said than done, but that's a goal. So really the tools I've just mentioned, keeping a sleep diary, track the sleep patterns and the progress and work out what the issues are. Number two, a visual schedule can be incredibly helpful, and social stories, particularly for autistic children.
Did you want to go into the different approaches to the different problems in a bit more detail?
Yeah, sure. So I think it's important to remember every child is different. So having a personalised approach for each child and their family is important, and that might need to change over time. There is no one size fits all. You can read all you like, but doing it with your child is really hard. So I'll start with the kids who have trouble falling asleep. It really depends on why they have trouble falling asleep. So if it's a sleep association, if a child is used to falling asleep with their parent in bed, when they wake up from a sleep cycle overnight, we all wake up, they will want that same sleep association to get them back to sleep. So think about yourself. If you fell asleep in your bed, but then you woke up in the middle of the night and found yourself on the couch, you'd be completely confused. Yeah. You'd want to go back to the bed and fall back asleep in that bed. So really trying to work out, you know, trying to decrease those sleep associations for all children is important. And teaching children how to fall asleep on their own in their own bed is, for most people, not everyone, the ultimate goal. The way to do this, there's a few techniques we use. One is called camping out and one's called the checking method. I'm not sure whether you've heard of them. So we'll put some information in the show notes. But with camping out, you're slowly increasing the distance between you and your child overnight. So if you're a parent who sleeps with your child, for the first few nights, maybe try sitting at the end of their bed while they're falling asleep and stay there till they fall asleep. And every two or three nights, try and move a bit further away from that bed. So have a chair, or it's called camping out because people have a camp tent on the floor next to the bed, and stay there for a few nights. Then move your tent or your chair to the door so that if your child wakes, they can still hear you. You can reassure them, keep it vanilla, as I mentioned, but you're just slowly moving yourself away. Then you move yourself outside that door, and eventually, usually it takes a few weeks, so be realistic about it, but usually a child would then learn how to fall asleep on their own. So that's the camping out method. The checking method is slightly different. So some children actually fall asleep more easily when their parents aren't in the room. So the checking method involves your child going in regularly to check on your child. So after your child's gone to bed, say goodnight, leave them, but promise you're going to return, and really importantly, follow through with that. So don't promise you're going to return and then go out for the night, because your child will definitely remember that. Some children need frequent checking, so, you know, every few minutes, but others you can have longer stretches, 5 to 10 minutes. But the goal of the checking method is to try and increase the intervals between the times you check them. So it might start at 2 minutes, gradually 5 minutes, gradually 10 minutes, and in time, hopefully you'll be able to separate from your child and they can fall asleep without having you in the room. As mentioned, keep it vanilla, keep it brief, keep it boring, and lots of praise in the morning. Children might also have trouble falling asleep if they're anxious, so really trying to work out what the cause of that anxiety might be. And it will depend on the age of the child and their cognitive capacity, their developmental age. But in general, some of the things we use for anxiety are relaxation techniques, mindfulness, meditation apps. So Smiling Mind is a local app that's very helpful and free. And for other children, a worry box or a worry diary might be really helpful. But if anxiety is a big player for parents, I think it's really important you speak to your support team, so a psychologist, a pediatrician, because your child might need more help with that anxiety. So they're the children who have trouble falling asleep. The next group, as Emily mentioned her child, was the children who have trouble going to sleep and waking late. So they have that delayed sleep phase and they just aren't ready for sleep when you want them to be ready. So in these kids, consistency is the key, and as I said, easier said than done. But one of the goals is to wake them at the same time every day, weekdays and weekends. And a technique we use for this is bedtime fading. So we temporarily set the bedtime later than the child would normally go to bed to make it easier for them to have a short gap between going to bed and falling asleep. Then we decide what the ideal bedtime would be, and we try and bring that bedtime forward by about 15 minutes every few nights, and we stop when that desired bedtime's reached. And often, once again, this will take a few weeks. So these techniques are not easy. You have to be ready for them, and they often take a few weeks. And the last one are those children who get up overnight multiple times. So once again, ruling out medical issues for those children is important, but there's a technique called the bedtime pass. So you might give your child a pass, they put it under their pillow, and they get one pass per night. And they can trade that for whatever they want, but you've had that conversation or worked that out in advance. So it might be a drink, a cuddle overnight. If they manage to go through the night without using their bed pass, lots of praise, lots of reward, you know, throw a party. But as they may use their bed pass, but, you know, really try and keep praising them, keep rewarding them, and then hopefully those overnight wakenings will slow down. But really the take-home message is choose one technique or approach, stick to it for a few weeks, and get that support that you need.
Thanks so much for that. It's so detailed, and yeah, like so much of it I can relate to being a child as well. And I think goes beyond just autistic kids, like you were saying. It's a really common thing, that reward system for when you're really just trying to get your child to go to sleep and you've tried different options. So I guess to you, Emily, from that list and beyond that list as well, could you talk us through some of the things that maybe helped improve your child's sleep, and what was that process like for you?
We tried quite a few different techniques, certainly the camping out and the checking in, and with varied success. Like I said earlier, sometimes I would be able to, she would still be there for hours, but could convince her to stay in her bed and at least get to sleep in her own bed. But then something may trigger her externally or in the environment to be not coping as well, and then it would all fall away again. So it felt like we were kind of constantly going back to square one. One thing that we did use a lot was there was one sleep podcast that she liked. So it was this one track that I can still hear every note in my head, because I've listened to probably thousands of hours of this one particular, but that did help. And I guess, like you're saying, that association, that song is associated with bed and sleep. Really the biggest thing for us was getting some medical intervention in terms of medication. That has then, and unfortunately for us, and I suppose because she was a bit later in being diagnosed as well, we didn't have a support team. So everything kind of really came to a head in her first year of school. And the sleep issues as well as, we really figured out that that's what was starting. So we weren't involved with a paediatrician. We're in regional Victoria, so accessing health professionals is actually quite difficult as well, seeing the same doctor. So even though we'd kind of had mentioned it to various professionals, maternal child health nurse, you get a lot of different feedback, and the onus I felt was really put on us not trying hard enough. And the first time I spoke to a GP for some support in some of the anxiety and the emotional issues that were happening, as well as the sleep, we brought up the sleep, and yeah, was basically told she needed some tough love. So there's a lot of, I think, dismissing parents that still happens.
Yeah.
And basically your child, and even I had a friend say to me once that she'll sleep when you're ready to put in the work. No longer a friend. But there's a lot of, so you're going through that with the sleep, you're going through that with the why is my child still not separating from me at school, why is my child still struggling with X, Y, and Z.
And it all speaks to a later diagnosis as well.
Exactly. And so for us, it's years of things being just not quite the same as everyone else. But nothing really stood out until it all came to a head and she had a severe mental health crisis, and fortunately was able to take her back to that same GP, and he immediately, I requested some sleep medication that a friend of mine who's a play therapist suggested that I ask for. So I had to go and specifically say, I think it's time, and that changed our life. I'm not exaggerating, that changed our life. It gave us our life back, and she fell asleep the first night she had it. She fell asleep within 10 minutes, and for 5-6 years of sitting there for 3+ hours every single night, it was just, I think I cried.
Yeah. You wouldn't have known yourself. It would have just been a surreal experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lexi,
are you wanting to add something?
Oh, no, I think you've explained it beautifully. We try behavioural techniques, and most parents, you know, try many things. Finding that support group and finding your people and your tribe early, really helpful. Having organisations like Amaze who put the effort in to make resources for parents about sleep and about other issues is incredibly helpful as well. So for families, knowing where to find those resources. But I also think there can be a role for medication, usually to try and break the cycle so you can actually do the work on some of the behavioural techniques. So, you know, want to emphasise, please try things, but go to your GP early. If you're not getting the response that you need, you know, look elsewhere, ask your tribe who to go to. And, you know, I wouldn't want anyone else to go through what Emily's been through, 3 years of really not having a night's sleep. I think we have learned a lot since then, and hopefully the message is out there now to most health professionals.
That's amazing, guys. Did you have anything else to add to that, Emily?
Yeah, I think also for parents just to really listen to their instincts. I think that's when life became a lot easier for us, when I was listening to what everyone else was saying and taking it. I've always known that she struggled with sleep. My husband and I both were very much the same. We had had much stricter parents who wouldn't let us out of bed, but both of us clearly remember for years laying there 3+ hours at night, unable to go to sleep. So I think, for parents, just listening to their gut and not being afraid to advocate for the child. I think I often didn't want to come across as a helicopter or too much, demanding, and probably took on board some criticisms a bit too much to heart. And our life has been a lot better since I've learned how to advocate, and that connection-based parenting with my daughter. So I'm tuned into really what's going on, what she needs, and able to advocate for her. Finding a paediatrician. We've got the most beautiful paediatrician. He's amazing. And having that support has just been vital. So definitely having someone, your GP or a specialist that you really trust and that sees you and sees the effort that you're putting in, that's been pivotal for us as well. So definitely finding your tribe in the professionals as well, making them part of your team. Yeah, I couldn't speak more highly of our PED, and we are a team with this kind of stuff. We work together to solve problems now, and that's been a huge benefit.
Yeah, having someone on your side to support you through everything would be so helpful, especially when you've gone through all the years of people trying to give you the well-meaning advice or trying to tell you exactly what your issue is when it's your own lived experience, and having someone who's completely across what you're going through would be so helpful. So I guess I'll just to wrap up the podcast, I'll go through some of the key takeaways from today's discussion. So creating a consistent and relaxing bedtime routine finding a routine that works for you and your child seems to be a really important thing. Having patience when implementing a new strategy, it may take a few weeks to achieve change. Things might temporarily get worse when you first implement a change, but improvement will come. Providing your child with a lot of encouragement and praise when getting them to change their routine. And general advice that if behavioural intervention and along with good sleep hygiene does not resolve insomnia, seek advice from healthcare professional on suitable pharmaceutical intervention. So yeah, it's like what you were saying, that seems to be a really, really helpful end point, getting to the pharmaceutical intervention. But there's also a lot of different behavioural intervention that happens prior to that.
Yeah, and after. Yeah, we've found it a lot easier to put in these good sleep hygiene, sleep habits, no devices, things like that when we're not all eyes hanging out of our head tired. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Did anyone have anything else to add?
I think this is a really important discussion, and hopefully with Emily telling her lived experience, it will help other parents feel confident to advocate for themselves and their child. So thank you for having us today.
Emily and Lexi, thank you so much for joining me today. It was so good to hear your lived experience, Emily, and your medical expertise and just all the experience that you were able to enlighten us with today. There'll be lots more information in the show notes, and you can visit the Amaze website to find more resources on autism and sleep. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.